It's Monday, November 18, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Americans were heartened over the weekend by the sight of United States Air Force planes bringing massive deliveries of emergency supplies and equipment to the nation of the Philippines, reeling from the disaster of Typhoon Haiyan, even as weather experts have confirmed what was reported last week, and that is that this massive storm may well have been the most powerful storm to have hit a populated area in recorded history. The death toll, according to the Philippine government, now exceeds 4,000, and the tragic reality is that those numbers are almost sure to rise. The government is undertaking a massive recovery and rescue operation. That means that rescue operations are continuing, the word rescue there implying that there is still the opportunity to save persons whose lives are imperiled by the storm. But even as the tragedy continues to be documented and humanitarian and relief efforts go on in the Philippines, part of the conversation taking place right now has shifted from what did happen to what could have happened. A review of recent decades indicates that when a storm like this hits, the immediate response to it makes all the difference often between life and death. Some death tolls in other storms that have hit the region include 1970s Typhoon Bola that hit Bangladesh, leading to 300,000 fatalities. Now, 10,000 casualties, if that's the number reached in the Philippines, will be an incredible tragedy. But just compare that to 30 times that figure, 300,000 dead in 1970 in one storm. Bangladesh was also hit by Typhoon Gorki in 1991, leading to 138,000 deaths. Myanmar, or Burma, hit by Typhoon Nargis in 2008 with 138,000 deaths. There are others here documented in the high five digits, and what this reminds us of is the necessity of responding to this kind of disaster and responding fast. This is something that the American military is actually very adept at doing. And the sight, once again for Americans, had to be encouraging, and far more than encouraging for the Philippine people, to see these planes landing with emergency equipment and supplies, bringing hope and, of course, much-needed water, food, and other equipment to those who now so desperately need it. Our lack of control over the weather is something that is affirmed time and again. That massive satellite image of Typhoon Haiyan that was revealed just prior to the storms hitting the Philippines demonstrates again how small we are over against the immensity of a storm of that magnitude. But even smaller storms can also be deadly. And in a remarkable outbreak of storms that came yesterday in the middle section of the United States, at least five people died in a tornado outbreak that is coming within days of Thanksgiving, very late in the cycle, after some of these same areas have already had snow on the ground. Even as communities now turn to rebuild and to comfort those who have suffered such loss, once again, we need to be reminded of the fact that it could have been otherwise here, too. The big change here has to do with the predictability of these storms, with the reality that weather radar and advanced meteorological analysis now allows for advance warning so that most people can get out of the way of these terrible storms even before they develop, much less touch ground. So that, at least, is something for which we should be thankful, even as we are continually mindful of our need to help those whose lives are in peril, whose lives have been devastated, whose communities have been destroyed, and whose loved ones are now lost. The biggest international news that came over the weekend was the announcement by the government of Communist China that it intends to make two changes. One is to relieve somewhat its infamous one-child-only policy, and the other is to end, at some unannounced future point, the use of labor indoctrination camps. Both of these are being signaled as big news coming from China, but both of them bear a closer observation. And especially the policy known as the one-child-only policy bears our very close moral consideration. Laurie Burkett, reporting for the Wall Street Journal, writes, China is tempering its controversial one-child policy, allowing more couples to have a second child in a surprise concession over a much-disliked control that comes as the country faces a looming worker shortage. She goes on to explain, couples will be able to have two children if one spouse is an only child. According to the wide-ranging Communist Party reform blueprint issued Friday of last week, the most significant adjustment in a policy that has defined Chinese family life for more than three decades, and perhaps the most dramatic policy change out of leaders' recent party conclave. Now, a closer look at this policy tells us that things have changed and things haven't. The most important thing that hasn't changed is that the Chinese government, a totalitarian government, we remind ourselves, claims the authority to make the decisions concerning childbearing and reproduction of happily married couples. In other words, to control the personal life right down to the most intimate of decisions. This is something that previous totalitarian regimes may have dreamt of, but only the Chinese actually put it into law in this way. Wang Fang, a demographer at Fudan University in Shanghai, said, quote, it's an historic moment in the life of this infamous policy. However, as the Wall Street Journal also notes, demographers say the shift comes too late to solve a looming labor crisis in a rapidly aging society. Very interesting development here in China. The necessity to make the change comes as China's population is aging remarkably. By the time China reaches the year 2050, at least 25% of the total population will be over age 65. China's working age population, says the journal, those ages 15 to 64, is drastically shrinking. From 2010 to 2030, China's labor force is expected to lose 67 million workers. That's more than the entire population of the nation of France. Some time back, Jonathan Last reported in the Weekly Standard that the age structure in China in 2050 will be such that there will be only 1.6 workers. Today, the country has 5.4 to support each retiree. That's right. Every retiree in China at that point supported by only 1.6 workers. You do the math quickly and understand that doesn't come anywhere close to being a workable reality. It is, in other words, a disaster, a looming disaster. You would think in light of that disaster, and by the way, that documents the date is 2030, you'll do the math, you'll realize that's only 17 years away, that the Chinese government has decided to relax the policy, but only a little bit. As Carl Balick of the Wall Street Journal says, this change in the policy changes it from a one-child-only policy to what might be described as a 1.5-only-child policy. It's an infamous policy, and it deserves to continue to be infamous. By the way, as was documented to the credit of even papers such as the New York Times and others, China is notorious in its implementation of this policy for it also leading to forced sterilization, forced abortions, and enforced contraception. You're talking about a situation in which you have the government reaching right into the bedrooms and the most intimate lives of people, and you also have a government that, in the name of limiting the population, has committed what might be seen in retrospect as a form of national suicide. As Chris Buckley of the New York Times reported on Sunday, for decades, most urban couples have been restricted to having one child. That has been changing fitfully with rules on the books that couples can have two children if both parents are single children. But that policy will now be further relaxed nationwide. Many rural couples already have had two children, and some have had more. But what you're talking about here is a policy that has worked far beyond the intention or the imagination of those who put it in place in China back in the 1970s. The evidence of that comes from the fact that the Chinese people have indicated that they basically now don't intend to have more children. Once again, the Wall Street Journal reports on this very clearly. Quote, even with the right to have more children, recent research on the impact of the one-child policy's various exemptions suggests fewer Chinese want them. The Shanghai government found in a 2012 survey that couples born after 1980 are willing to have only 1.2 children on average. The average number of children born per couple in the city of Shanghai is actually 0.7. Well below the rate of population replacement, needless to say, and also below the one-child policy. In other words, people in China have been influenced by this policy no longer to try to have children. In contrast, before 1970, the average Chinese woman had 6 pregnancies in the course of her lifetime. Carl Balick, the numbers guy at the Wall Street Journal, again points out that the situation is even more morally corrupt and alarming than many Americans, much less Chinese, have recognized. He writes, limits on childbirth have skewed society in other ways. Some parents selectively aborted female fetuses, leaving China with a current male-to-female birth ratio of between 1.13 and 1.17, depending on the source, compared to a worldwide ratio of 1.05 to 1.08. In other words, that's a huge indication of female abortion and infanticide. He goes on to say some demographers expressed hope that the option to have a second child would reduce sex selection abortions, although others pointed out that some studies have found parents of a daughter have even more extreme male-to-female ratios for their second child. End quote. Based on numbers available by the United Nations and its population projections, it doesn't look like this change in China is going to lead to any significant change in reproduction that might account for an improvement in that long-range projection. If indeed there are 1 million more babies born in the coming year than the 15 million babies expected, that will not add up to anything that will come even close to closing the gap in terms of this population situation. Furthermore, even if Chinese couples decided to take every advantage of this policy, however it is defined, and take it to the limit, those children who would be born over the next several months or years would not enter the workforce until about 20 years out. In other words, too late. China has already faced this kind of situation in the past, the infamous broken branches situation there, because of the one-child policy and the privilege to male children and the abortion of female children. This has led to the situation in which there are literally millions of young men in China who will not have the prospect of a bride. And you cannot create young brides. That decision had to be made many years ago. It's too late. This is the great and horrible problem of totalitarian social engineering. It not only fails, in its failure, it brings on huge human tragedies. When you try to have a totalitarian state that reaches right down into the most intimate decisions that should be left at the level of the family, you wreck the society. That is now even recognized by the panic that has led to this policy change in China, but the change is only so slight and it comes now so late that it shows that a totalitarian government is unwilling to either release its control over the society or to respond fast enough, even when an emergency has advertised itself now for some time. Meanwhile, back to Jonathan Last in his article, America's One-Child Policy. He points out that not only does China have a one-child policy, the United States does too. It's a very different policy here, however. It's not a state-enforced policy. To the contrary, there is no state policy on this at all. There is no state intrusion into the lives, the reproductive lives of couples. That's not what's being discussed here. But American couples, given consumerism, education, delayed gratification, and the prolonged adolescence, have also decided to have fewer children. How many fewer children? Well, the American birth rate right now is 1.77, unless you take in recent immigrants, where it goes slightly over 2. In other words, we have willingly, voluntarily, in our own disastrous way, adopted a one-child policy. An increasing number of adult women say they do not intend to be mothers. They do not intend to have children. And as Last points out, we have a fall-off on marriage, we have a fall-off on children, and the two are not disconnected. Demographer Nicholas Eberstadt years ago pointed that at the current projections in many of the largest population centers of the world, cities such as Beijing, Shanghai, Tianjin, it appears that the average number of births per woman is so amazingly low that it will be below one baby per lifetime. In other words, the idea that it will be normative, that a young woman would get married and become a mother, this is now so disconnected from reality in some societies and some cities that it just isn't a part of the way people live and the way they imagine how human beings are supposed to live. If this sounds extreme in China, it turns out that the situation is even more acute in the small island nation of Japan. As Last writes, culturally speaking, Japan's fertility problem is a marriage problem. As Japanese women began attending college at greater rates in the 1970s, they began to delay marriage. By 2000, the average age of first marriage for college graduate women in Japan was over 30. At first, these women simply postponed childbearing. Then they abandoned it. Today's college-educated Japanese women have, on average, barely one child during their lifetimes. End quote. From a Christian worldview perspective, there are few barometers of the moral state of a culture or a nation more significant than this birth rate and the way the culture thinks of children and the gift of children. What we're looking at here is a dramatic reversal in the way human beings throughout history have thought of children. Children have almost universally been welcomed. Indeed, generations have seen it as one of their primary responsibilities to give birth to the generation to come and to raise that generation successfully to adulthood. All that now seems to have been changing. Changing in China by a totalitarian government's intention with a draconian, inhuman policy. But changing in nations such as Japan, and even in the United States, by voluntary decisions made by people whose priorities are revealed to be more consumerist and educational and professional and indeed personal than familial and parental. We're looking at a major shift in the way human beings live. It's a moral shift. Demography may not be destiny, but it always is a great moral indicator. Just a few days ago, I discussed last week's cover story in New York Magazine entitled My Abortion. It included a very significant set of testimonials by women who had had abortions, some of them several abortions. And as I pointed out in the article, the abortion testimonies really reveal several things, but most significant, they reveal the fact that the baby simply will not disappear from the picture. As much as those who push the abortion rights argument want to ignore the baby as a morally significant agent, the baby shows up even in these testimonials in some very haunting, indeed morally significant ways. I published that article last week. It's at my website this morning, entitled Their Abortions, What Do These Abortion Testimonials Really Reveal? And then interestingly, just in recent days, at Slate.com, an article appeared entitled Feminists Are Sharing Abortion Horror Stories, and That's a Good Thing. Olvi Anderson writes an article that is in itself counterintuitive. She writes, "The past few weeks have seen a spate of articles about the downsides of abortion and contraception." She then lists them, including some that appeared most significantly. Well, she mentions the New York Magazine article, and then she mentions one that appears in Elle. She then writes, "You'll notice that Elle and New York aren't right-wing religious publications. In fact, a sizable portion of their readers and writers probably consider themselves feminists and support reproductive freedom. It may seem counterproductive for progressive publications to be sharing stories of abortion and contraception-related woe and trauma at a time when states like Texas and Oklahoma are putting our reproductive rights at risk. In fact, it's a great development," end quote. Why in the world would she say this? Well, then she writes, "I regret my abortion and the pill is dangerous stories have traditionally been the stuff of anti-abortion propaganda campaigns. As a result," she continues, "pro-choice women have hesitated to share stories about regretted abortions or about the unpleasant side effects of the pill for fear of inadvertently giving fodder to pro-lifers and anti-sex activists." But she counters that with her argument, and I quote, "It helps no one when women feel that their feelings about their own personal experiences with abortion and contraception are somehow not okay, which is why it's wonderful that New York and Elle are reclaiming these stories from religious conservatives." I'm not actually questioning whether Olvi Anderson believes what she writes here, but I am questioning as to whether she can possibly be right in what she writes here. Because what she writes is that she thinks these stories will actually be evidence of the fact that abortion is gaining ground morally rather than losing it. And yet, to read these testimonials and the articles to which she even links in her article make it almost inconceivable that it could be so. As I pointed out in terms of the New York Magazine cover story, the very collection of these articles was done in order to get people, women in particular, to speak more openly about their abortion. And yet when they do, it's hard to believe that this helps in any way the pro-abortion argument. Olvi Anderson may be writing to say it's a good thing, and yet my guess is that those who are on the pro-choice and pro-abortion side reading the argument that she makes aren't going to buy into it. If anything, they're likely to continue to argue that the very revelation, much less publication of these stories, breaks the unspeakable taboo against bringing forth these kinds of stories, because they amount to a massive assault on the moral senses. As I write in my article, available at my website, if the purpose of these articles is to assist women to overcome the stigma of abortion, it's hard to imagine that they succeed. The fact that articles appear four decades after Roe is proof that the decision failed to reset the nation's conscience on abortion. The pro-life movement faces huge challenges in the task of reaching the nation's conscience, but we need to recognize there are also great opportunities. These articles reveal both in full force. I end that article by citing a poem by Bryce A. Taylor entitled "How to Have an Abortion." It originally appeared in the November issue of the journal First Things. He wrote, "Don't think about the freckles he or she might have, or how much hair, how big a grin, or whether swimming would come naturally, or whether it might play the violin. Don't think of prom, don't think of puppy love, or calculus, or snow, or spring in bloom, or anything that might remind you of the future now contained within a womb. Don't feel anxiety, don't feel regret, don't fret about some otherworldly guilt. Don't feel the bond of parenthood, don't let insane, outmoded Don Quixote's tilt. At private windmills, don't spill any ink. Examine yourself. Don't feel. Don't think." End quote. I think the real power of these articles reveals the fact that women will not follow that last line in that eloquent poem, "How to Have an Abortion." They won't stop feeling, and they won't stop thinking. As these articles indicate, they won't stop telling about it either. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.